At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank. Focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If I could, I'd chuck the whole thing. No more news about the housing market. No more stories about every twitch and hiccup of mortgages and home sales. Because every time you turn around, it's different. One month real estate's up, one month it's down. Of course, you can't just not cover such a huge part of the economy, especially on a day when it's down. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's Thursday, June 14th. Good to have you with us on this Flag Day, everybody. It's not often you sit down and you can't quite figure out where a story starts. But today's developments in the housing market present exactly that problem. In no particular order, we learned today adjustable rate mortgage delinquencies are up, specifically in the already troubled subprime market. Mortgage rates, meanwhile, have hit their highest point in a year. Freddie Mac said today home buyers will pay 6.7% for a 30-year fixed. And Wall Street powerhouses Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns announced their quarterly profits suffered at the hands of their mortgage portfolios. There's no shortage of ideas on how to deal with ailing borrowers and lenders. Fed officials heard some of them at a hearing today in Washington, but Marketplace's Bob Moon reports the central bank's being urged not to overreact.
The patient's condition is delicate. Fed officials made it clear today they're walking a fine line between curing the nation's mortgage ills but preserving incentives for responsible lending. The housing slump is getting worse, not better, and the Fed is under pressure from Congress to quickly use or lose its legal authority over the mortgage industry. Some consumer advocates say treatment is years overdue. At the National Consumer Law Center, attorney Elise Cohen says state laws protecting borrowers are inconsistent, and that calls for a federal fix.
The only way to really keep up with this is to have a rule that says mortgage companies who are acting in an unfair or deceptive way are liable to the homeowner, and the homeowner can protect themselves with such a rule.
Some kind of action is needed, says Chicago Sun-Times personal finance columnist Terry Savage, to stop the abuses that got us into this mess.
Many of those mortgages originated by brokers who were in it for the flat fees, $1,000 for every mortgage they turned in to a mortgage company. Many people committed fraud. Others were duped into committing fraud by mortgage brokers.
The Mortgage Bankers Association sought to emphasize the flip side of its foreclosure report today, pointing out 8 in 10 holders of subprime adjustable mortgages are paying on time. Still, the association's Doug Duncan concedes lenders have mounted what he calls an all-hands-on-deck effort to work with borrowers.
They are aggressively restructuring loans for people who largely, due to circumstances beyond their control, are in some difficulty.
Personal finance writer Terry Savage says it's a problem that needs everyone's attention.
It's a blight on our cities. It's a hit to our financial institutions. And in the end, we all pay.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Years of negotiations mixed with some threats and cajoling have paid off for New York City. J.P. Morgan Chase said today it's moving back down to Lower Manhattan at the World Trade Center site. Mayor Michael Bloomberg and New York Governor Eliot Spitzer are hoping Chase will encourage others who left after September 11th to head back downtown. But Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports getting the bank cost a pretty penny.
J.P. Morgan Chase will invest about $2 billion to build its new headquarters near Ground Zero. Steven Spinola heads the Real Estate Board of New York. He says the bank will act as an anchor.
It will say to tenants, look, if J.P. Morgan is leading the way, why shouldn't we consider it? And why shouldn't we go down there and be a neighbor with J.P. Morgan?
Which he says will help the area's real estate market.
It probably just increased the asking rents for office buildings in Lower Manhattan because of J.P. Morgan's commitment.
Plus, he says all those bank employees will spend cash in neighborhood stores, but all those economic benefits won't be cheap. The city and state are paying J.P. Morgan around $200 million worth of incentives to move there. Officials say their incentives available to any company that builds downtown. And it's a lot less than J.P. Morgan had originally asked for. In 2005, competitor Goldman Sachs got a reported $650 million to move downtown. Chase wanted the same deal. Economist James Parrott is with the Fiscal Policy Institute, which looks at New York budgetary issues. He says New York shouldn't have to pay to get high-rolling tenants.
With the strength of the real estate market in Manhattan today, there's absolutely no need for public subsidy to induce construction.
Around 7,000 bank employees will move to the new building from the company's current headquarters in Midtown. The building's supposed to open in 2012. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
George Eastman invented rolled film back in the mid-1880s. It let photographers do away with those clunky glass plates. Today, the company he founded announced it might well have eliminated the need for the flash bulb. Kodak says it's got a new technology that'll let photographers take crisp, clear pictures even when there's not enough light. Our New York bureau chief Jill Barshay reports now on what it might mean for Kodak, which has bet the ranch on its digital future.
Kodak trotted out its snappy new invention for digital cameras today. It's the latest part of a transition that began 3 years ago when the company realized that rolls of film were no longer clicking with consumers. Dennis Lohaus is co-owner of Bryce Capital Management. He says the company's overhaul from old-fashioned film to digital photography isn't going smoothly.
So while they are growing digital, their cash flow business, that film business, shrank, I think, far faster in the last 3 years than they would have anticipated.
Kodak's digital camera business still isn't big enough to support the company, but Kodak does have a host of scientists who are hard at work on new technologies. Today, they said they figured out a way to let more light through a camera shutter. They say the invention will let people take pictures in dim light, even in the dark, without a flash. Chris McNiff is an executive at Kodak. He plans to license the new technology to other camera makers next year. He's hoping it will be used in a variety of cameras, from Nikons to the ones in Nokia cell phones.
There may be cases where you know it's a Kodak sensor and cases where you don't, but hopefully the experience that you have with the digital camera will be that much better because it has Kodak technology inside.
McNiff wants to expand Kodak's licensing business. Analysts say the company seems to be positioning itself as more of an inventor and less of a manufacturer. Kodak was brought low when technological advances overran its business model. Now it's hoping a new focus on technology can save it. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
Investors like the picture at Kodak. Shares were up 8% today. The bond market calmed down, so other investors continued their buying ways, even in the face of crude oil at its highest level in almost a year. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let's come back to the housing market for a second with this question. What do we do now? Once we get past stories about subprime mortgages and whether or not rising interest rates will sink real estate even lower, is there a way to bring the market back? Commentator John Vogel has a plan.
Imagine that every homeowner living in Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Rhode Island were facing foreclosure. That is the situation today with 2 million families now on the brink of losing their homes. And now we've got a second crisis in full swing. A lack of affordable housing. We can solve both problems at once and do it in a cost-efficient and humane way. I'm calling this plan the Last Chance Mortgage Fund. Homeowners want to keep their homes. Lenders don't want the hassle and publicity that accompanies massive foreclosures. And the government doesn't relish the idea of an industry or homeowner bailout. So we could set up a mortgage fund by selling government bonds and using a little taxpayer support. The fund would let homeowners refinance their current mortgages at a fixed rate of 3%. This last chance mortgage isn't a free pass for homeowners. Families who take this mortgage would give up the right to sell their homes at a profit. If we'd done this 10 years ago, when the median price of housing was $122,000, we'd now have a stock of housing that teachers and firemen could afford. The last chance mortgage is also not a bailout for lenders. Plenty of lenders lent out large amounts of money for overpriced housing, and now they have to take a haircut. All the major lenders would have to agree to accept a maximum of 90% of the appraised value of the house as repayment for their mortgages, even if that means a loss. One question that always comes up is, if homeowners can't make a profit, will they continue to maintain their houses? To solve that problem, we'd require homeowners to escrow a small percentage of their mortgage payment for repairs and maintenance. The last chance mortgage won't save everyone, but it's better than holding hearings while neighborhoods fall apart.
John Vogel teaches real estate and nonprofit management at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Send us your thoughts. Marketplace.org is our website. All you have to do is click on the link that says Contact. Twenty-five years ago, not too many people would have been able to find the Falkland Islands on a map. Today, most still can't, but at least they know the name. The war between Britain and Argentina over the islands off the Atlantic coast of South America ended 25 years ago today. Remembrance services were held in both London and Port Stanley, the Falklands' main city, which is where we reached Dr. Andrea Clausen. She's a member of the Legislative Council there. Dr. Clausen, good to speak with you.
And you.
You know, any country changes in 25 years, any economy does. How has it changed for you since 1982?
The Falklands has really fundamentally changed since 1982. Prior to 1982, our gross domestic product was around £5 million per annum. With the establishment of the economic exclusion zone in 1986-87, we were able for the first time to sell license fees to fishing companies. And almost overnight, our gross domestic product rose to over £30 million per annum. And today, it's peaking at around £75 million.
So it's fair to say that that exclusion zone that let you control fishing rights out for a couple of hundred miles, that's your cash crop now, isn't it?
It is indeed. We also have potentially hydrocarbons on the horizon, although in terms of how our economy is run and how the government runs its budget, we don't take into account anything that might happen. But that exclusion zone, of course, also gave us the control of the offshore mineral rights as well.
Hydrocarbons, so drilling for oil.
Yes, we currently have 7 operators in the Falklands, and one company has been ready for the last year, year and a half, to drill. But of course, the rig market is so tight at the moment, prices are so high due to world demand. We are still relatively remote in the world in global terms, and so it's proving quite difficult to get a rig into our area.
£75 million for an economy of 3,000 people is quite a bit of money. What are you doing with all of that money?
We have invested fundamentally in infrastructure, schools, hospitals. We have put a lot of money into training our young people. Prior to 1982, young people in the Falklands didn't really have access to university education and so on. We pay fully for students from the Falkland Islands to attend university overseas. And we're also, for the first time, getting close to implementing a cross-sound ferry. The Falklands has 2 main islands, and that will have an absolutely radical effect for the rural area, particularly West Falkland, where they haven't had such bright times in recent years with the collapse of the wool market.
Change can be a tricky thing, though, especially when it comes so quickly. Are you having any problems?
I don't think so. I mean, we are still a relatively crime-free society. You can still leave your house unlocked, your keys in the ignition of the car. You won't get mugged. Of course, money brings with it a range of other things. And I guess because people had no money prior to the conflict, they didn't really care about material things. That would probably be the only thing in my mind that's changed. People are more materialistic now. But otherwise, we're still a very close-knit community. And when the chips are down, we're all there for each other. And I think it's a very special place because of that.
The Honorable Dr. Andrea Clausen sits on the Legislative Council of the Falkland Islands. Dr. Clausen, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
We also called around to a few Falklands locals to get a better sense of what the years since the war have meant to a place that used to be a little more than one big sheep ranch. Hi, is Miles Lee available, please?
Yeah, you're talking to him.
Miles Lee is a fifth-generation sheep rancher on West Falkland. That's the area Dr. Clausen was talking about that's pretty isolated. We chatted for a while once we got him on the phone, and then I asked him how business was going.
Not too good. You don't want to be a farmer if you're trying to get rich, really. I'm sure there's not many of your friends that wear a woolen garment, and that's the crux of the matter, really.
Well, this is Los Angeles, so there's not too much wool here to begin with, you know.
No. Is
there a way you can give us a sense of the standard of living? I mean, what kind of cars do folks drive down there?
Most people drive 4x4s. Most people drive a car that's no more than about 6 or 7 years old. There's been 700 kilometres of road built in these islands. We barely had tracks before, and lots of individual homesteads have a road right to their back door now.
And they didn't used to have that?
No, it was all just overland travel across open country.
Tell me about where you live. Describe your property for me.
We've got about a dozen houses here in a small valley right next to the sea, with a sort of largest hill snow-capped behind us. There are not many people here. There's only 20, but you know everybody.
Could you describe for me the way the economy down there has changed in the past 25 years since the war?
Beyond all recognition. In just this last year, we've formed a wool marketing company. Probably 50% of the Falkland Island farms have joined that, and we've employed a worldwide marketer. That's a product of the good economy, because the Falkland Island government is supporting that company and giving it money to research and improve the sales.
You have children, Mr. Lee, right?
Just the one.
How old?
He's only 3 months.
Well, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm wondering, though, what you think your child's life might be like in 10 or 15 years?
I think it'll be fairly similar. The majority of Falkland Islanders remain in the Falklands.
What's the appeal, do you think?
It is a comfortable place to live. There isn't any unemployment in the Falklands, so everybody has a job. It's just not the sort of, whatever you call it, the rat race, like you see all these dreary commuters heading off to work every day. You don't do that. It's about a 3-minute walk down here to work. I come home for lunch.
Sounds like a pretty good life.
Yeah, I think it is, yes.
Mr. Lee, thank you so much for your time.
That's all right. Cheers.
That was Miles Lee from West Falkland. He's a sheep rancher there. Coming up, you can walk the walk, but can you talk the talk?
She actually said, Emily, we need to get the neat out of your voice.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial shot up 71 points today, just over 0.5% to close at 13,553. The NASDAQ climbed 17 points, 0.2% to end at 25.99. The S&P 500 rose 7 points, nearly 0.5% to close at 15.22. The gains came despite a Labor Department report this morning announcing wholesale prices for May rose sharply, but excluding food and energy, as you always have to do, they rose just 0.2%. That calmed inflation fears. In the financial sector, Goldman Sachs fell more than 3.3%. Bear Stearns foraged up just a fraction. Systems and technology company Computer Sciences fell more than 2% after its fiscal 08 outlook fell short of expectations. Slim pickings for pharma company Sanofi Aventis. Its shares fell 4% after the FDA recommended against approving its weight loss drug Acomplia. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for May. A House committee checks on the fundraising books for the Kennedy Center and the Smithsonian Institution. And a ban on cockfighting goes into effect in New Mexico. That leaves Louisiana the sole U.S. state where the sport is still allowed. However, lawmakers may soon pluck the activity from there as well. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
Truth is, it's often responses to our commentaries that fill up the inbox around here. On Tuesday, Ben Stein offered his thoughts on the energy bill that Congress is considering. He said if lawmakers raise fuel efficiency standards, then fewer ordinary folks will be able to drive the cars they love, and instead they'll have to buy hybrids. Prius owner Don Duggan Haas from Hamilton, New York, said, hold on just a second.
Well, I wonder about why we don't ban private jets and yachts. I found his defense of SUVs coupled with the belittling of hybrids troublesome. Stein is right that the rich need to do their share. Ecological damage is not something we want to equalize if it means catching up to the rich.
Last week, Adam Posen weighed in on the Chinese currency. Beijing's been accused of keeping the UN artificially low, which has raised some hackles among American manufacturers, including car makers. They've been pressuring Congress for legislation to right the imbalance, and Mr. Posen said that's fine, but don't lump Japan, which is Detroit's main competition, in with China. Stephen Collins is the president of the Automotive Trade Policy Council. It's one of Detroit's big lobbying groups.
Japan's manipulated weak yen has contributed not to Japan building more cars in the U.S., but to exporting more vehicles now to the U.S. than 20 years ago. There's nothing protectionist about Congress insisting that countries like Japan allow their currencies to reflect market fundamentals.
GlaxoSmithKline's diabetes drug Avandia has been in the news. The FDA recently decided it deserves the strongest possible caution, what's called a black box warning, on the packaging. Dr. Stefan Kertész said part of the problem with Avandia and other drugs lies not with the FDA, but with private healthcare standards groups. Dr. Kertész said they often don't disclose the financial interests their experts have in a particular drug. Margaret O'Kane's the president of the National Committee for Quality Assurance, one of those standards groups. She heard the program that day that Dr. Kertész was on. She offered this response.
NCQA creates quality measures and guidelines through an open, transparent process. These measures use widely accepted scientific evidence to support informed clinical decision-making. But final decisions about care are always between a doctor and a patient.
And finally, a correction. In a story Monday about the rising price of milk, we quoted an economist as saying energy drinks like Red Bull are one reason for the price hike. That's because they use whey, a byproduct of the cheese-making process. Turns out some of them do, some of them don't, and Red Bull doesn't. If you have comments or corrections for us, our website's marketplace.org. This being radio, we put a lot of emphasis on how people sound. In all honesty, though, we're not the only ones. Voices matter in the wider world of work, too. Every now and then, there's just something about the way a person sounds that makes it hard to concentrate on what they're actually saying. It happens with men, of course, but our reporter Ashley Milne-Tite noticed that it's often women, younger professionals in their 20s or 30s, whose voices have a youthful quality. She asked around about how women's voices matter to their careers.
I may have taken inappropriate political considerations into account on some occasions, and I regret those mistakes.
That's Monica Goodling, the former Department of Justice official who testified before Congress last month about the U.S. attorney firings. She's 33 years old.
I don't believe I intended to commit a crime.
Sheila Wellington cringes every time she hears women like Goodling who sound years younger than they are. Wellington teaches a course on women in business leadership at New York University's Stern School of Business. She says that all-important first impression can be determined by a woman's voice as well as her looks. So it worries her that more and more of her students have voices that make them sound like kids.
They're little girl voices that project, take care of me, be sweet to me, I'm vulnerable, I'm weak.
Wellington suspects a touch of post-feminist backlash may be behind these baby voices. She says most of her students shy away from describing themselves as feminists, a term they seem to associate with man-hating harridans. She thinks they might be unconsciously pitching their voices particularly high to signal their feminine credentials. Or they could just be following the lead of the current crop of young Hollywood role models, who often sound like Alicia Silverstone's character from the movie Clueless.
And it's like, when I had this garden party for my father's birthday, right? People came that, like, did not RSVP.
So Emily Lonegro says her voice was never that bad, but her boss did ask her to take some voice training.
She actually said, Emily, we need to get the neat out of your voice.
Lonegro likes the sound of her voice now. She's mastered exercises to relax her lips, throat, and tongue.
So that your voice can actually flow out of you instead of getting all caught up right in your face. Or if you're keeping your mouth shut, it's like this, and it gets really small.
Deborah Tannen teaches linguistics at Georgetown University. She's written several books, including Talking from 9 to 5, Women and Men at Work.
Women in authority are in a double bind.
If they sound too young, Tannen says, they run the risk of not being taken seriously. On the other hand, if a woman sounds too authoritative...
Well, that kind of undercuts our expectations for femininity or for a woman. So she kind of has to choose between being a good authority figure and being a good woman.
NYU's Sheila Wellington says it's important for women to cultivate a strong voice. She says a woman who sounds like a child risks being treated like one.
In terms of career success, it's not a good thing. I don't think children get the responsibility to lead.
Emily Lonegro is delighted to have left her little voice behind, but she hears others like it all the time. She says most women want to be liked and accepted, and having a forceful voice can get in the way of that, particularly in the workplace.
Making declarative statements is kind of intimidating. It's a lot easier to say, I'd like to talk about our annual report today. Then I'd like to talk about our annual report today.
Lonegro's already seeing the difference a change in a voice can make. She says her voice training has done wonders, not just for her presentation, but her confidence as well. All in all, she says, she feels much more professional. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we go. Today, online fantasy baseball is in a very real court battle. Attorneys for Major League Baseball are arguing that online fantasy companies have to pay for the use of players' names. A federal appeals panel is hearing the case against St. Louis-based CBC Distribution and Marketing. The bottom line's pretty real here. Fantasy leagues are $1.5 billion a year industry. Yahoo, ESPN, CBS, and some other big media companies already pay baseball millions to operate fantasy leagues in cyberspace. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 71 points, about a half a percent. The NASDAQ picked up 17 points, two-thirds of 1%. The S&P 500 added 7 points. That is half of 1% there. Our editors include John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, good help is hard to find, especially when you're not paying.
If you were to take a permanent job and try to run it with volunteers, it would probably take 5 volunteers to replace 1 paid person.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.